Hello, my name is Nicholas Ward, and this is Historical Hysteria. Today, we are jumping back to 1914 and the favourite story of every British elementary schoolroom, the Christmas Truce of 1914. With World War I raging and trench warfare set in, disillusioned soldiers in Germany, France and Britain sat in the cold, damp fields of France and Belgium and thought of home. Who started the Christmas Truce is impossible to say, but on Christmas Eve, Christmas Day and Boxing Day 1914, over 100,000 soldiers patchwork negotiated a series of informal truces all along the Western Front. Letters and journals of soldiers suggest the truces started with the erecting of Christmas trees in German lines, followed by mutual singing of carols. In some sections, reports claim incredibly brave or suicidal men began getting out of their trenches and sitting on the parapets. In others, junior officers nervously negotiated truces before tentatively climbing out into the open air. And in one of the most surreal moments in modern warfare, soldiers across the Western Front crept into the blood-soaked fields. Guns were put down, and men who had spent the last few weeks shooting at each other shook hands, sang, smoked, ate, and drank together, culminating in a series of famous football matches. Soccer, for you American heathens. The Christmas Truce is the kind of story that sounds like a myth from ancient history, but incredibly, all of this is true. We have thousands of accounts, letters, and dispatches describing the events with utter disbelief that hundreds of thousands of blood-soaked, hard-bitten veterans spontaneously decided to put aside their arms, snipers chose not to fire, and artillery commanders chose not to let loose their deadly volleys. And on Boxing Day, the 26th of December 1914, soldiers got back in their trenches and started shooting again. And despite the horrors and deprivations of the war, there are some things that make us all the same. And every year on Christmas Eve, the Christmas Truce held and nothing bad ever happened again. Thank you for joining me, and that's all we have time for, and what's that? They did what? Corporal Hitler said what? But I don't want to tell that story. All right. For Britain, France, and Germany, and the British Commonwealth, the Christmas Truce is held in a kind of awed importance. British and Commonwealth school children have the Christmas Truce drilled into them in primary school. Unfortunately, school generally skips over what happened next. But believe it or not, not everyone at the time was thrilled by this brief peace. General Sir Horace Smith Dorrien described one of the greatest displays of spontaneous humanity in history, saying, quote, "This is only illustrative of the apathetic state we are gradually sinking into," end quote. Future French President Second Lieutenant Charles de Gaulle described the peace as lamentable. Sir Dorrien was one of Britain's most renowned generals, and spent December 24th through 26th trying to ban truces. As news of the truce spread to the rear, the general staff had mixed reactions. Some ignored it, some disbelieved it, and others viewed it as a fantastic opportunity to kill people. And in one of history's most incredible acts of bravery, soldiers across the front line ignored orders to get back in their trenches to start killing their brief friends. Somewhat. The truces were mostly held in places where the lines had been quiet for a time, but along the Western Front, the majority of soldiers had no such luck. Shelling continued through Christmas, and the majority of soldiers had no chance for a truce. The famed football matches are also somewhat questionable. They became the defining pacifist image of the war, but there are few accounts mentioning them. One came from a truce between Scottish and German units. A British officer recalled watching in amazement as the Scots produced a football and made goals with their hats and shot wide. While Germans reported how shocked and hilarious they found it that the Scots weren't wearing underwear. One German soldier wrote after the war, quote, "Us Germans really roared when a gust of wind revealed that the Scots wore no drawers under their kilts." The accounts generally don't go into too much detail about these football matches, but given the state of the ground in no man's land, it seems very unlikely that any proper football matches took place. The truce varied across the front. Some stretches involved two-day truces, tours of enemy trenches, and trade of food and tobacco between both sides. Some truces were far shorter. One Alfred Anderson, one of the last surviving veterans to witness a truce, described his experience in 2003. Quote, "I remember the silence. The eerie sound of silence. Only the guards were on duty. we all went outside the farm buildings and stood listening. And of course, thinking of people back home. All I'd heard for 2 months in the trenches was the hissing, cracking, and whining of bullets in flight, machine gun fire, and distant German voices. But there was a dead silence that morning, right across the land, as far as you could see. We shouted, "Merry Christmas," even though nobody felt merry. The silence ended early in the afternoon, and the killing started again. It was a short peace in a terrible war. End quote. Newspapers initially refused to print stories of the truce for fear of censorship. But in the new year, they tentatively began reporting on them to fascinated audiences back home. But for the various Western military high commands, Sir Dorian's assessment that this was a problem was the dominant thought. Various laws quickly written forbidding fraternization with the enemy. Over 1915, propaganda was ramped up with exaggerated and fabricated stories of extreme cruelty becoming more common on all sides. For many Canadians, the image of the war is of a poor man crucified against a wall, which is a shame because the story is almost certainly fictitious. But these stories of crucified soldiers and barbarous opponents became the norm for fresh recruits to terrify them and to dehumanize their enemies, driven on by this Christmas truce. And as December 25th, 1915 approached, German, British, and French high command took further steps to prevent truces. Rolling artillery bombardments were ordered for Christmas Day, and where possible, trench raids were ordered and encouraged. And so, come December 25th, 1915, you will never guess what happened. Everyone stayed in their trenches, cowering from endless bombardment, and hang on. This can't be right. My notes say that people tried again. Yes, after another year of brutal war with high command breathing down every ground commander's neck, fraternization punishable as treason, and bombardments pummeling the trenches constantly, frontline soldiers across the Western Front tried again. In the Vosges Mountains, French and German soldiers met and exchanged cognac and wine for bread and ham. With guns still pounding the lines, British and Germans sung carols to each other and rushed into the fields come dawn Christmas Day to trade. In Belgium, one senior officer, Sir Ian Colquhoun, was court-martialed for defying orders and negotiating a truce with the Germans to retrieve and bury their mutual dead. Though high command saw it as an unacceptable breakdown in morale and did everything in their power to stop it, there was still numerous soldiers more than willing to take the risk both from enemy bullets and their own. 1916 and 1917 saw attempts at truces again, but as the war got bloodier each year and the generals got more ruthless, it became more and more difficult to organize these truces. And so by 1916, the inevitable happened. That's right, with it becoming almost impossible to organize a Christmas truce, the truces began to spread outside of Christmas. Despite the best efforts of the generals and politicians, truces not only spread, but became a regular aspect of trench life in some places. Soldiers would dig or repurpose trenches within throwing distance of an enemy trench as trade trenches. In Gallipoli, during some of the bloodiest fighting of the first half of the war, the Anzac Corps and the Ottomans unofficially organized trade trenches where Australians and Kiwis would throw tinned meat and the Turks would throw back tobacco. Elsewhere along the Western Front, commanders sometimes just straight up lied to high command. Since raids had to be orchestrated on the ground, frontline officers decided when and where to raid, and would sometimes just not. "Oh, yep, we totally raided that trench. Go ask him if you don't believe us." Commanders caught onto this, unfortunately, and started demanding proof of raids, and guess what happened? Now, this one isn't 100%, but there are various anecdotes from after the war that in some sectors, enemy soldiers just began exchanging dog tags as part of their trading, instead of conducting raids, and would sometimes warn opposing trenches that a raid was coming, so that they could evacuate it. There are even reports from later diaries about soldiers in quiet sections warning their opponents of artillery bombardments. And these weren't tiny isolated incidences. Trade trenches would become increasingly common across the Western Front, and it was almost impossible to stop soldiers doing it. In many ways, the real miracle of the Christmas truce was that it wasn't confined to Christmas. In a vast and pointless sea of death, these were tales of true heroism. Not killing X number of people by rushing straight into the enemy, but risking death from the enemy and from your own by simply refusing to fight. Unfortunately, things did not always go smoothly for these brave soldiers trying to negotiate these truces. One of the most poignant stories comes from December 25th, 1915, on the battlefield of Ypres. A freshly deployed Canadian corporal, George Dahl, recalled how a German soldier rose out of his trench waving a box of cigars and yelled, "Merry Christmas, Canadians," and was promptly shot through the head, sparking an intense firefight. This was one of the first deployments of Canadians during the war, and perhaps unsurprisingly, there were fewer Canadian-German truces. But not none. When the Canadians arrived at Vimy Ridge, some reports say the Germans held up signs saying welcome, and come Christmas, smattered truces managed to hold. According to Robert Axelrod's Live and Let Live, it became common in very quiet parts of the trenches for soldiers to literally walk around out of their trenches, but within range of the enemy during the day. Much of what we know of the many, many truces throughout the war come from journals, diaries, and letters from the soldiers, and given there were some 40 million men in the trenches over 4 years, we still probably have much to learn from the letters and diaries in private collections about what happened during the war. But again, not all stories are so cheery. With High Command desperately trying to convert these soldiers back into killing machines, well, stories like that of the poor brave German shot while waving a box of cigars became more common. Canadian troops would gain a reputation for brutality during the war that was not wholly unearned. Canadian forces were often used to shake up quiet areas of the trenches and to break these unofficial truces. Commander of the Canadian Corps, Arthur Currie, after the war even bragged about his force's cruelty. In one instance, a new force of Canadians learned about the local trade trench where the Commonwealth exchanged tinned beef with the Germans. The Canadians began lobbing tins into the German trench. The trade trench quickly filled with Germans who called out to talk to their new neighbours. Once it was full of Germans, the Canadians began throwing in bundles of grenades. Canadians, along with the Nepalese Gurkha, would also gain reputations as night raiders, where other commanders were doing literally everything in their power to avoid raiding enemy trenches. The Canadians had a reputation for never shying away from them. Veteran Philip Gibbs described the raids as, quote, "There were screams of German soldiers, a terror shaken by the flash of light in their eyes and black faces above them and bayonets already red with blood," end quote. Canadians also gained a reputation for taking no prisoners. Quote, "They had the nerve to throw up their hands and cry, 'Kamerad!' All the kamerad they got was a foot of cold steel through them," end quote. War crimes aside, I can't honestly say Canadians took less prisoners than other groups. Unfortunately, there are no comprehensive studies of executed captives. But this reputation led to Canadians getting fairly harsh treatment from the Germans. And much of the Canadians' reputation seems to have come from the violation and exploitation of these unofficial truces when arriving on the Western Front. Which says a lot about World War I. The commonality of these truces and the betrayal that the Germans felt at having them violated. Though the Germans were not exactly innocent of the same strategy. Among the British and French, Prussians gained a reputation for unusual callousness and cruelty. Many veterans would recall how desperate they were to be sent against Saxons, Bavarians, Swabians, or any other Germans, anyone other than the Prussians. How true these stereotypes are, again, is impossible to say. On a side note, something I found quite curious when researching this episode. The cruel Canadians is often explained away as the depravities of war, as war crimes often are. After all, if people have suffered beyond belief, then their excesses are more understandable. But strangely, the Canadians actually suffered far fewer casualties than their allies, and fought in fewer theatres than the British or Australians or many other Commonwealth forces. they suffered one of the lowest percentage of casualties amongst Commonwealth forces, suffering lower casualties per capita than the Kiwis or the Newfoundlanders. Which perhaps raises an interesting question about why they were more brutal. Because many of the stories I can find of actual Canadian brutality weren't of battle-hardened veterans, but were of fresh troops straight out of Canada. It's almost like people put into these horrific, soul-crushing situations didn't lose their humanity, but found it in the trenches. But that is pure speculation on my part. And let's quickly get back to the Christmas truce. The Eastern Front also saw a smattering of Christmas truces in 1914 between Austro-Hungarians and the Russians. In some areas, these truces were quite formal and long-lasting. Around the modern Polish city of Przemysl, besieged by the Austrians, Habsburg forces issued a Christmas ceasefire and placed Christmas trees into no man's land. Soldiers met and exchanged schnapps and tobacco for bread and meat. But the Russians, still on the Julian calendar, wouldn't celebrate their Christmas till our January 7th. And were no doubt in for a miserable day, until Austrians unofficially ceased firing to allow them to celebrate anyway. The Eastern Front saw fewer and more scattered truces, and the more mobile front lines would have made the social contract built in the West harder, no doubt. By far, the truces in 1914 along the Northwestern Front between the British and the Germans were the largest and most well-known of the truces. Why this happened is very debatable. The smaller truces along the French line may have reflected the bitterer sense of the war felt by a people whose homeland was being invaded. Meanwhile, for the British and Germans thrown into a foreign war in a foreign land, there could have been a greater sense of the arbitrary. Another possibility is the long connection between Germany and Britain. Germany has a long cultural connection to English culture. One of the world's oldest Shakespeare literary societies was founded in Weimar, Saxony in 1864. And in the lead up to the war, many young Germans worked in British hospitality. So English was already widely spoken amongst a certain class of Germans. In one trench, a young German would sneak into a ruined building at night overlooking a British trench and call out asking about London. The soldiers took pot shots at him until an officer called out asking who he was. And he replied, quote, "Ah, the officer, I expect I know you. I used to be head waiter at the Grand Central Hotel." Amongst the Germans, many felt the war was a Prussian war, not a German one, and Germans from units from further south often suffered low morale. Though, again, this certainly wasn't universal. One young Corporal Hitler, sitting far from the front lines, read about the truce with horror and denounced it, demanding to know if Germans had any honor left. Despite the opposition, the opportunistic murder, the constant danger, and the court-martialing of soldiers, the truce would be held on and off for the remainder of the war, standing as a beacon of humanity in one of mankind's darkest wars. That is all we have time for today. Thank you for joining me. Feedback can be sent to historicalhysteria@gmail.com, and don't forget to check out the socials, r/historicalhysteria on Reddit and @manichistory on Twitter. But before I leave, let me leave you with this. Us Germans really roared when a gust of wind revealed that the Scots wore no drawers under their kilts, and hooted and whistled every time they caught an impudent glimpse of one posterior belonging to one of yesterday's enemies. But after an hour's play, when our commanding officer heard about it, he sent an order that we must put a stop to it. A little later, we drifted back to our trenches and the fraternization ended. Lieutenant Johannes Niemann. Sources for today included The Forgotten Ferocity of Canada's Soldiers from National Post, Commemorating the Christmas Truce, A Critical Thinking Approach for Popular History, Catherine McDaniel, Christmas Truth, Still Remembered, CBC News, Reasons.com, There Was More Than One Christmas Truth, and the Smithsonian Magazine's The Story of the Christmas Truce. Goodbye.